Good morning. Happy Easter. I'm so glad you're here. Yeah, wow. We're like ready this morning. Yeah, it was awesome. My name is Chris Causey. If you're new, I'm lead pastor here. And this is the biggest day of our year. This is the biggest day of the Christian faith. And so just to kind of give you a heads up, if you're coming and you're like, wow, this seems to be a really excited group of people, it's because we get what Easter's about. And it's my goal in the next 27 minutes that you leave with a deeper appreciation of not just the what of Easter, but a little bit more of that. So one of the things you need to know about me is I'm married to an incredible woman named Jenny Causey. And if you were to ask me, yes, she is also awesome. And if you were to ask me what is it I love about being married to her, it's that she makes me feel really funny. I don't know if you've got that person in your life. Like when you say something, they just laugh. Like you're good at being funny. And so one of the things that I do is, we'll send GIFs to each other or GIFs, however that battle line's drawn in your household, word-wise. But one of the things I've been doing recently is sending Venn diagrams, okay? So not only am I humorous, I'm nerdy, all right? Because, there's no other way to, turn up the romance than a Venn diagram, okay? This is just how it happens. And so this one is like one of the ones I sent to her recently. It's bank robbers, DJs, preachers, and mom taking off your sweater. I'll let you Google this one later to fully appreciate the genius. But what they all have in common is put your hands in the air, right? So it's like throw your hands in the air, and it's all of them. Google it later because they're even funnier. And so I've actually been trying to come up my own Venn diagrams because I'm like, these are funny. And so I was laying in bed one night, and I'm like coming up with one because I was having trouble sleep. And it's like Saving Private Ryan, Guardians of the Galaxy, Fast and the Furious. And I was like, she's going to love this one. She's going to think this is funny. And because it's Vin Diesel, it's a Venn diagram. I was like, this is even better than the DJ one. And she's like, good try. Not really. So like I finally redeemed myself because I sent her one more, and it was philosophy professors, Backstreet Boys, for those who are in the room who are a little on the non-1900s side of life. This was a boy band that sang and danced, all right, in the 90s. And so the common theme is, tell me why. Yeah. And so that's the line. And what I loved about this one was I sent it to her, and then I started thinking about, this was in the midst of me preparing for the Easter message. And I was like, you know what? I think that sometimes there's a disconnect between the Easter what and the Easter why. We know the story. Even if chances are you walked in today and you didn't really grow up going to church, someone dragged you, begged you, promised to feed you, tricked you, and you walked in the door, the chances are is you probably got the what of Easter down pretty good. Jesus, a carpenter turned rabbi about 2,000 years ago, starts a movement over the course of 3 years, gathers huge crowds to himself teaching and preaching, and then that becomes the spark that causes political pressure and religious jealousy that ends up having him crucified on a cross. And then 3 days later, the stories begin to circulate that his body is no longer in the tomb and that he's been risen from the dead. And that message spreads throughout the Roman Empire, and in the course of 300 years, completely upends the Roman Empire. Like, most of us have some semblance of the what. But like these three groups, the why is where the power is. The why is where the life change happens. The why is the Easter story that changes our story. Because I would argue that it's just a story about Easter until it starts to impact your story. That's when Easter really becomes the Easter story, is when your story is no longer the same. And to take you on that journey this morning, I want to take you to a passage where the why is very clearly on display. It's only three verses. It's really short. It's a very small little interaction. And it's one of those moments that you can actually miss how profound the interchange is and what happens. It's also a part, if I'm being honest, if I was going to create a religion, I would have never written. I would have never made this section up because this would have been embarrassing for me. And most of us don't tell embarrassing stories about ourselves, and we definitely don't write embarrassing stories for the next 2,000 years to be told about us. And so it just lends a little bit of weight that this moment's probably rooted historically in what actually happened that day. Because no self-respecting human who's ever trying to start a religion would have ever been this brutally honest. It begins in John 20, verses 19. If you have a smartphone and you want to follow along, we have an app, encounterchurch.com/app. It's free. You can download it. The scriptures for the day is already present in there. But it says, on the evening of that first day of the week, and the first day being Sunday, that's how it was counted. So just the kind of, let's timestamp this thing. It's about 33 AD, and it's about 6 p.m. on Sunday night. This is the first Easter day. And we don't find the disciples, we don't find the small group of guys and gals in the room celebrating. We find them in together with the doors locked for fear of the Jewish leaders. They're all gathered in this room because they're terrified that the next knock on the door is going to be the Jewish leaders who've come to finish this thing that they started through crucifying Jesus. And they're scared. They don't know how this is going to turn out. They'd been holding on to this miracle that maybe Jesus had a plan, and now it's clear that he doesn't. His body, he was crucified, and he was stuck in a grave, and when that 1,000 to 100, 1,500, because it's been estimated to be over 1,000-pound stone, when that 1,000-pound stone was rolled over that grave, it wasn't just Jesus' body that was being buried, it was their hopes and their dreams. They had bet their whole life on this guy. For 3 years, they had followed him faithfully. They had seen him do things that no one else had ever done before. They'd heard him say things that no one else had ever said before. They were amazed. And they not only watched Jesus do all these things, they were there at the very beginning, so they saw when it was just them in a wedding in Canaan. And the party got started, right? And they saw that, and they saw how it started to grow. And then crowds of thousands upon thousands, and then the feeding of the 5,000, which is estimated to be 25,000 people because the 5,000 were just the men. So they saw this thing. I mean, in the ancient world, the idea of a rabbi carpenter attracting 25,000 people to hear him speak is mind-blowing. I mean, those were significant numbers that we take for granted today because we can walk into a Red Sox game or go into the Garden. But, I mean, you have to realize these guys would have seen in the world. And then on that day, it all fell apart so fast because that Thursday night, they'd been eating dinner together and they were celebrating Passover, and Jesus leads them out to pray in the Garden of Gethsemane, and they're out there and they're praying, and all of a sudden a Roman soldier, a troop of them arrive, kind of accompanied by the religious leaders of the day, and they arrest Jesus. And the disciples, they scatter, they flee. A handful of them, just to kind of follow along a little bit, but Peter's one of them, who's Jesus' most vocal kind of disciple. And he ends up abandoning Jesus by the time the morning starts to rise, the morning sun begins to rise. And so on Friday when he's crucified, most of the disciples, with the exception of one, aren't even there to see it happen because they're so dejected, they're so broken, and they're so dismayed at what has played out. Now, they didn't have to be there to know what was happening to him because to live in the Roman world was to live with crucifixion. There's a little bit of a debate about the Assyrians and the Persians and where it began, but it began within a people group that spread to the Roman Empire. But it was the Roman Empire who maximized crucifixion as a torture and execution method. They were the ones who realized that you could increase the pain and increase the time to death through crucifixion. So they loved it. They would crucify their enemies, and if they were really wanting to make a point to a town where maybe a rebellion had been thrown up, they would sometimes take the leaders of the town and just lined their bodies up on crosses through the streets. So as you walked into the city, it was no doubt in your mind who had the power at that time, and it was the Roman Empire. And the way that crucifixion killed you was not blood loss. They would have seen crucified people. The way you died in crucifixion was that your body would be hung on a cross and the nails would be strategically pierced so that you would be in maximum pain and that you would either die of one of two ways. Asphyxiation, your body would get so weak you could not breathe anymore after being on the cross for 5 to 9 days with animals encircling you. Or you would die from a heart attack. Those were the two ways. So the disciples had full picture. But what made it worse for Jesus was that Jesus had been beaten throughout that Thursday evening through a despicable and horrible whips with bone structure and glass mixed in so that to make sure that he was beaten to the point where he could barely walk. It was recorded he was flogged, which is 40 minus 1, and the reason why is because the Romans were so good at torturing, they knew that 40 lashes killed people, but 39 kept them alive. So they beat him to the inch of death. Around 27 lashes, you pass out because your body can no longer handle the shock of the brutality of it. And then he is forced to carry a 75-pound beam uphill to the place they were going to crucify him. That's why Jesus does not make it very long on the cross. Because when he gets on the cross, according to Christian theology, then the weight of sin and shame and guilt from us came upon him. And most likely he perished from a heart attack with his heart broken because of the weight and the brutality on his body. And that's why they're all there. Because you don't come back from that. You don't wake up from that. You don't come out of the ICU from a coma 7 weeks later and you're like, I'm here, boys. Had a little bit of a rough patch. It's over. They're terrified. And what I love about this passage is just how human it is. They're being honest. They're afraid. But it's human because we all understand what it's like. We've all been in a place before where our own hopes and dreams have been buried, where we find ourselves on the other side of a tomb, and inside that tomb was a grief, was a disappointment. It was a dream job that we thought, man, this is it. This is where I'm finally going to be happy. And that door closed. Or maybe it was the day after our divorce. And everything that you thought you knew and all the hopes that you'd slid those cards in on, it's over. Or maybe it's on the other side of a diagnosis and you're staring at your life and what you might have left. Or maybe it's the first heartbreak you had in high school, middle school, or college. And you thought, man, I could never love again because love just got buried in that grave. But we all know what it's like to be them. To be on the other side of a grave that's been sealed and there's no way it's going to be rolled back. And we look at our kid who's gone distant from us, who's run away, and we think there's never any chance that they're ever going to come back. Or we look at our spouse and think, man, there's never going to be a moment where we have the feelings that we had when we first said, I do. And in the midst of all of that despair and all the hope and the disappointment that had been buried in the grave, the only thing that was still alive was regret. Again, it resonates with us. They understood regret. Man, I wish I'd been there. I wish I hadn't been a coward. I wish I hadn't turned my back. And then what happens next is one of those things I just want to slow down on because I don't want you to miss it. It says that Jesus came and stood among them and said, peace be with you. Again, this is so profound. Just a few days ago, these group of guys had promised, we've got your back, Jesus. We'll never abandon you. We'll never forsake you. We are part of this thing with you. We are your ride and die, Jesus. We're here for you. And then they can't stay awake while he's praying. And I love the phrase, Jesus came. I mean, I think sometimes it's good to hit pause and say, okay, What does this say about God? Not just read the sentence, but let the sentence start to read into your life. What does this say about who he is? And the phrase, Jesus came, says a lot about him. Not just that he came as a baby in a cradle, not just that he came to the cross to be crucified, but he comes to this group of people who are dejected, who are just completely dismayed, who have nothing but regret when they think about Jesus and despair. And he doesn't walk in and say, you losers. He doesn't walk in and says, where were you? What were you thinking? What were you doing? No, he walks in and he gives them what is a common greeting for the day. It's, in fact, the same phrase translated into Hebrews, two words that if you were to drop into Israel today, you would hear it. And this word morphed into Arabic and became a phrase that if you were to drop into any Islamic community, you would hear the same kind of version of this phrase. This is a very common Middle Eastern greeting. It's peace be with you. It's the almost the casual equivalent of hello, how are you? Jesus walks into the room and he doesn't belittle them. He doesn't guilt them. He doesn't come in with a whole, boys, I got some lightning bolts. I'm about to light you up, right? He doesn't come in with that. He comes in and he meets them where they are. And it says, after he said this, he showed them his hands and his side. And the reason he does this is because up until this point, there have been about six people that day who've claimed that they've interacted with Jesus. Now, again, if I was writing this, this is not how I'd write it. I would not show that I had doubt. I would not show that there was disbelief. I would not show that I had questions. These disciples are gathered in the room terrified because they're not sure Jesus is alive. Because dead people have a pretty good record of staying dead. Right? Like, when's the last time you went to a funeral? And they were like, surprise! And if that happened, would any of you stay? No, someone else would die being run over trying to get out of the room. I'd be like, oh, I've seen zombie movies. I know how this goes. Right? Like, I'm not staying here. Somebody's about to get eaten. It's not good. And so they're like, these people are filled with grief and they're hallucinating. Maybe they've seen Jesus' ghost. And so when Jesus shows up and he shows them his hands and his side, he's doing it to show I'm not a ghost. Because if I was a ghost, you would not see scars on my body because they did not pierce me with some spiritual spear that like cut my ghost skin. Okay? Like just super practical here. You see this? This is my physical body. I've got a new body. And I'm alive. And it's only at that point that the disciples were overjoyed when they saw the Lord. They're like, oh my goodness, you are alive. You're real. You're here. And it starts to hit them. And this is the beginning of Easter. But this is still the what. This is not the why. Jesus is about to imprint the why on them. Again, Jesus said, peace be with you. He's like, guys, I think you missed it. I think you got so caught up in the fact that I've come that you thought I was being casual when I walked into this room. And there was nothing casual about me coming into this room tonight. So he repeats the phrase, peace be with you. There's a reason he repeats it, because they didn't get it the first time. This was not hello. This was, hello, do you realize just what happened? Hello, I was dead, now I'm alive. Hello, do you know what that means? Peace be with you. Like, my daughter this past week, she was talking about this moment where the teacher earlier in the week was like, hey, kids, remember Friday, we don't have school. And they were like, why don't we have school on Friday? And another kid was like, oh, a teacher was like, well, it's because it's Good Friday. And they're like, well, I get it's a Good Friday because we don't have to come to school. But like, what does that mean? Like, why is this one the Good Friday? And another kid's like, well, I think this is the day Jesus died. And then like most of the class was like, that sounds like a horrible day. How is that a good day? And this is why it's a good day. Because Good Friday would have remained the worst Friday had Sunday had never happened. This is why he walks into the room and he says, peace be with you. Because this single act of him coming out of the grave redefined everything. It transformed how we viewed it all. All of a sudden, Friday was a good day, not because of what happened on Friday, but because of what came out of Friday. And we all get that as humans, right? Where maybe it's, I listened to country music growing up, all right? And one of my favorite songs that got me through, like, just the heartbreak of high school was Garth Brooks' Unanswered Prayers, okay? Right? I don't know if you know that. Let me give you a second. It's like, some of God's greatest gifts are unanswered prayers. Like, the whole song is about seeing his high school sweetheart and how that heartbreak just completely decimated him, but he meets her with his wife. And I just, like, we get it. Like, my life is so much better because of Jenny. And because of Jenny, my two kids. Because of a heartbreak. So something I would have never said was good. Now I look back on it, it was the greatest thing that ever happened to me. And that's the cross. It was the worst thing that could have ever happened to the most perfect one who had ever lived. The only one who had never been guilty was crucified for our guilt and our shame. Like that, worst day ever, opens the doorway to the greatest day ever with the empty tomb. Because it means that peace can be with you and me too. It means that guilt and shame no longer have the power over our life. It means that the chains of addiction no longer have to drag us down. It means that life can happen before death, not just after it. It means that there is a power that is available to you and to me that can give us joy and peace when our world is falling to pieces. That's what he means when he says, peace be with you. I have conquered the grave. I have conquered sin and death. I have come back from the dead. I have killed it and crushed it. I am alive. What has been done to you and done by you no longer gets to define you because I define you because of what I have done. Like, that's the peace. Hello, peace be with you. That's what he was trying to communicate. Is that our lives can experience a new beginning because of what he's done and how he's come. That is the why of Easter. That the resurrection power wasn't just limited to 2,000 years ago, but it was unleashed on you and me today too. That you have the potential to wake up and to walk in that. Jesus said, peace be with you. As the Father has sent me, I am sending you. He's like, no, no, no. This power, it's not just limited to your life. It's what I want to do through your life. So if you've been coming for a while, you know that my family and I, we're in the midst of this cancer journey. And God and just his grace this week just gave me this like beautiful kind of moment where Wednesday I was in my first day of chemo and I was in my bay and I have a pump right here that connects straight into like my heart so that the drugs get in fast and they go far places. Also can handle 300 PSI, which I'm like, why do I need a pump that can handle 3 PSI? We're not pressure washing my body, okay, on the inside, but that's a whole other random fact about that pump port. And so anyways, my wife always comes with me. She's my best friend, and I just love looking at her while I'm being poisoned. I feel like that could be like a Rihanna song. I don't know. But anyways, and so like she goes and grabs our morning snack. And she leaves and the nurse walks in and she says, Chris, and I said, yeah, Joyce? She's like, can you do me a huge favor? And I was like, yeah? She was like, there's a young lady. This is her first day. She's really nervous. And she's thinking about getting a port. It's gonna be a lot. Would you be willing to go talk to her and show her your scar? And I said, yeah, of course. And so I walk in and I pull back the curtain of the bay, and there she is, and she has on her face the same feeling that I felt when I walked in my first day. She's terrified, she's scared, she's overwhelmed, she's drowning. And there's her mom and her brother and her boyfriend, and they're all, and they have it on their faces too. Because she's just way too young to be in here. And my opening statement is, hey, I'm about to underwhelm you with my body. It says, full disclosure, I'm going to have to pull up my shirt so you can see my port. So I pulled up my shirt and said, I told you it was underwhelming. I said, but here's my scar. And here's how it goes in. And I was already hooked up at that point. And so she could see the IV flowing into me. And I just saw it on her face. I said, hey, here's what the procedure was like. I said, it was painless. It was easy. It's so much better than having an IV in your arm. I've had way too many needles in the last 6 months of my life. And look, I get it. It's not. And then I just went personal. I was like, look, I know you're scared. I was so scared. I know it's terrifying because you have no clue what you're getting ready to walk into. And I just want you to know, I know. And I see you. And I'm praying for you. And that what a mentor of mine told me 12 rounds ago, because I just completed my 13th round, was there'll be a day where you actually get good at this thing, where you'll correct the nurses. You'll remind them of things they're forgetting to do. You'll be like, hey, make sure you pull that piece really well because the barb will get stuck when you pull out the port needle. Like, I was like, there'll be a day where you'll actually be good at this. And you won't walk in with as much terror as you feel like now. Today is the darkest day. And I went to leave, just reminding them I'd be praying for them. And the guy, her boyfriend, stopped me and said, who are you? And I said, my name's Chris. And he was like, thank you. And I walked back to my bay, and I was by myself, and I just started to cry. And I'm not saying I said this phrase because I'm not there yet. I didn't say, God, thank you for the cancer. But I was like, God, thank you that I was here today. And I was thinking about this passage and this message, and I was like, oh my goodness, that's what you did to me today. You knew Wednesday, 9:30 a.m., I would be there, and she would be there too. And you orchestrated that so that I could go into that bay sent on your behalf to let that young woman know that she's not alone, that you love her, and that you're with her just as much as you've been with me. And I literally just sat in the room and I just cried. I was like, God, thank you for that privilege. And my wife walks in and she's like, man, you look like you're on cloud nine. I was like, I am. I just got to help someone. I remember what it was like for you and me on this first day. And I got to be that person that we didn't have that day. And I'm just saying to you, if you follow Jesus, this is your life invitation too. It may not be a chemo ward. It may be a ball field with your kids. It may be a boardroom. It may be a doctor's office. It may be in your own household. But living sent with purpose, that God has a plan for you and a design for you and a desire for you to reflect that hope and that power. And you may be thinking, Chris, there's no way I could do what you did. And I just want to remind you through an introduction, not just about Easter, but I want to introduce you to Kamani Marouge, who attended Kap Kin Du Wu Primary School. Now, Kamani really wanted to go to school, but he, like other kids in war-torn African countries, was pulled into a war and never got to go to school. And so as he got older, he kept feeling this weight of, man, I want to go to school. I want to learn to read. I want to learn to write. I want to know how to count. And so he petitioned as an older person to go back to school. And they're like, no, there's no way. And he's like, but I never got to go. And Kamani eventually was approved and walked in as an 86-year-old man into first grade, breaking the Guinness Book World Record of the oldest first grader in human history. And there was a documentary made about him and the enthusiasm, the excitement of learning how to read and learning how to write and learning how to count, and how his classmates, these kids had never seen a camera, so they weren't even like distracted when they were filming it. What's distracting is his enthusiasm and his discipline. He was so on it. And I think Kamani is a reminder to us, no matter where you are in your spiritual journey, it's not too late. If he as an 86-year-old man can show up to first grade, then maybe you and I, no matter where you are in your spiritual journey, can take the first step of faith too. For me, it was August 7th, 2001, where I met Jesus. Not in a physical sense like the disciples did, but in a journey of reading theoretical physics books and biochem and wrestling with, is there a God? And if there is, who or what is it? And coming ultimately to a place where realizing Jesus was in fact God and that he in fact did die on the cross and come back from the dead, because the fragility of the Christian faith was, think about it. The only thing that the Roman or religious leaders of the day had to do to stop Christianity was just show up with the body. Like, it's the most fragile way to start a religion ever. Again, if I was making up a religion, I would not have done that, because it would have been like, oh, here's the body. And you're like, I thought we buried it better, right? I mean, it's like, this thing falls apart with the body. And the fact is that, well, you could say, well, the disciples, they buried the body and they hid it. But the problem with that is then all of them died a martyr's death. You can die for a lie that you never knew was a lie. But you're not going to psychologically die for a lie that you orchestrated. You'll come clean. And this is the reality of where I ultimately landed, was like, Jesus, I think you're God. And I think what you did on that cross was for me. And I don't have an intellectual belief, although I do have an intellectual belief. Christianity does not tell you to check your brain at the door. Christianity actually demands that you bring your whole body, mind, and soul into the relationship. You bring everything. And that day, I began to follow him, putting my trust in what he did. And so when I had my cancer diagnosis, the thing that I've never feared at all is dying. Because I have so much trust that when I take my last breath on this earth, I will open my eyes and see him. That's trust. Not fear of how I failed, but knowing that I'm covered by him and what he was done, that it was paid on the cross. And maybe for some of us, that's the first step for you, is that you need to look into the Christian faith. And I would just challenge you. Don't dismiss it. Maybe you grew up in a tradition that gave you a lot of reasons to be dismissive. But I want to encourage you, reject that, not Jesus. And we've created, a friend of mine recorded just a 10-minute video that just explains the question, what does it mean to be a Christian? And we've made that available on encounterchurch.com/faith. Look, and if you want to have serious conversations, there's not a question you're going to ask that I haven't already thought about, that I don't already love to answer, right? I mean, if you want to talk about Neanderthals, dinosaurs, right, whatever, like, we can go there. It's fun. I enjoy it. You may not find it fun by the end, but I find it fun, okay? Yeah, I do Venn diagrams as humor, okay? Like, that's my Barry White is Venn diagrams, people, okay? So you should be advised, okay? And then maybe for some of you, you've been walking with Christ, you've been journeying in the Christian faith for a while, but what you want to do is you want to grow in that. And we've created a class called encounterchurch.com/activate. It starts this Thursday, April 4th. It'll run 12 weeks, but it's every 2 weeks. So it's 6 sessions. And it's just a way of helping you take the next step and growing in your own faith. But these two steps, I think, are great next steps coming out of Easter. Because the why of Easter calls us into a deeper searching and a deeper recognition and a deeper awareness of who he is, right? That we are not people who follow Christ who are holding out for a miracle. We are holding on to the miracle. That's who you are if you're a Christ follower. You're not holding out. You're holding on. You're holding on to an empty tomb that's a reminder that there will be one day for you an empty grave too. And that the empty tomb does change everything. And that the empty tomb means anything is possible. It means your marriage, your relationship with your kids, your finances, your job, that sickness, even my cancer, anything is possible. The heartbreak that you're walking through, the uncertainty of your future, anything is possible. This is how I want to end it. I just want to give you a picture that hopefully burns into your mind. It's a picture I've been thinking about a lot. I had AI generate it because I was so fixated on this idea in my head of this man standing overlooking the desert holding an umbrella. And you can see there's this ancient riverbed that snakes through the desert. But he's not holding the umbrella because of the sun. He's holding the umbrella because he's prayed for rain. And I'm just like, God, I want this to be the posture of me living sent, of walking into rooms, walking into relationships, walking into spaces and places with this boldness of faith, of someone who's willing to pray for rain when all I see is a desert, and to have an umbrella in my hand prepared for it to pour down, for the rivers to begin to flow, and for new life to begin to infuse what's now dead. This is why Easter matters. This is why Easter matters for the people in your life, because you are this person for them. Over your kids, over your neighbors, your friends, and even your enemies. This is who you're meant to be, because that is what Easter demands of us all. Let's pray. Father, thank you. Thank you for the privilege of being here this morning, of being able to celebrate you and what you've done and how you've come. I pray that you would, in our own hearts, God, that you would stir inside of us a desire to see you work, that even now that you would bring people to mind, that you would bring circumstances to mind of the deserts in our own lives, where people need us as sent people to be the people who pray for the rain. And I pray that we would see in this year, in the days in front of us, your Spirit move and work in ways that simply we just can't even fathom right now. And so thank you, Father, for that privilege, for that honor. And I pray that we would see another one, another miracle and a sign that just reminds us that we're a people who are holding on to the miracle of all miracles, the only miracle that'll never be taken away, the only miracle that changed everything for eternity, your son's resurrection. And it's in your name, Jesus, I pray. Amen. All right, so here's how we're going to wrap up today.